From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tomorrow night, the Philadelphia 76ers and the Los Angeles Lakers face off in Game 4 of the NBA Finals. On today's Fresh Air, we talk to Lakers coach Phil Jackson. The Lakers currently lead 2-1. Jackson has already won 9 NBA championships, one last year with the Lakers, 6 as coach of the Chicago Bulls, and twice as a player with the Knicks. We'll talk about the finals, his strategy against the Sixers, coaching Lakers star Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant, and how the Lakers compare to the Bulls. Jackson has a new book called More Than a Game. Coach Phil Jackson, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. A federal jury in New York has imposed a life sentence without parole on one of the convicted embassy bombers. The jurors said they could not reach a unanimous verdict in favor of death for the man they convicted of blowing up the U.S. embassy in Nairobi, Kenya in 1998. That attack killed 213 people, among them 12 Americans. From New York, NPR's Melissa Block reports.
Defendant Muhammad Alawali showed no visible reaction when the jury rendered its verdict, but his lawyers called it an extraordinary victory. Defense attorney David Baugh.
In light of the McVeigh situation and all else that's going on, I think it says a lot of very positive things about our country.
U.S. Attorney Mary Jo White said the government felt the death penalty was the just punishment, but she added, we respect their verdict. Some victims' family members said they were deeply disappointed by the jury's decision. Howard Cavalier's wife, Prabhi, was killed in the Nairobi blast.
I know my daughters and I would have been given the opportunity to experience a certain sense of closure were Mr. Alawali sentenced to death.
The jurors came up with 5 factors on their own that mitigated against a death sentence, among them that executing Alawali could make him a martyr, also that lethal injection is humane and the defendant might not suffer. Melissa Block, NPR News, New York.
Bush administration officials told the Associated Press today that the Palestinians have accepted a U.S. plan for a ceasefire with Israel. CIA Director George Tenet and Palestinian leaders reached agreement in talks today on the West Bank, according to the American officials. Israel had already agreed to Tenet's suggestion that an 11-day ceasefire be extended in hopes that new peace talks could begin. The United States will resume diplomatic talks with North Korea next Wednesday in New York. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The talks will take place at North Korea's mission to the United Nations. The U.S. will be represented by a newly appointed special envoy for North Korea, Jack Pritchard. Pritchard will be meeting with Lee Hung-chul, the North Korean permanent representative to the U.N. The Clinton administration held extensive talks with North Korea over 8 years and was near an agreement to freeze Pyongyang's ballistic missile tests and exports. But President Bush suspended those talks in March to the dismay of South Korea as his administration carried out a review of its policy. Last week, the president announced those talks will continue. They will focus on North Korea's missile programs, implementation of the 1994 agreement that froze its nuclear weapons program, the current deployment of conventional forces on the Korean Peninsula, and needed humanitarian aid for North Korea's hungry population. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
President Bush was immediately on the defensive today as he began his first European trip. At a news conference in Spain, he defended his proposal for a missile defense shield and reiterated his lack of support for the Kyoto Global Warming Accords. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 26 points today, closing at 10,948. The Nasdaq dropped a fraction. This is NPR News. There's been flooding in Florida and Georgia as remnants of Tropical Storm Allison moved through from Texas and Louisiana. Florida officials blame 4 deaths on the storms. Street flooding in Tallahassee has been widespread. Cleanup efforts continue in Texas and Louisiana. Most roads are back to normal, but many people are returning to their homes to find them flooded and muddy. New research shows that antibiotics after a tick bite usually prevent Lyme disease, but that does not mean most tick bite victims should be treated. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
People get Lyme disease from deer ticks. It causes fevers, fatigue, and even severe arthritis. But only about 3% of people who are bitten actually get sick. And then antibiotics usually offer a cure. So doctors generally don't give drugs to everyone with a tick bite. The new study, though, finds the preventative approach is effective. Researchers looked at about 500 victims of tick bites in an area where Lyme disease is common. The scientists found that a dose of antibiotics within 3 days of a bite cut the risk of disease by 87%. Lyme disease experts say that suggests preventive drugs are a good idea where Lyme disease is rampant. But elsewhere, they said, doctors should reserve treatment for people with symptoms. The research will appear in the New England Journal of Medicine. John Hamilton, NPR News, Washington.
Ford Motor Company said today it estimates third-quarter North American production is down 10% from the year earlier period to 930,000 vehicles. Ford said its car production is down nearly 20%, truck production down 5%. The latest cuts follow declines in the second quarter as Ford continues to deal with a slow market. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at saabusa.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Los Angeles Lakers and the Philadelphia 76ers face off again tomorrow night in Game 4 of the NBA Finals, with the Lakers ahead by one game. My guest is the coach of the Lakers, Phil Jackson. He's had an extraordinary career. He led the Lakers to the championship last year. It was his 9th championship after winning 6 times as coach of the Chicago Bulls and twice as a player with the New York Knicks. Jackson has a new book written with Charlie Rosen called More Than a Game that covers his time with the Lakers. Jackson's earlier book, Sacred Hoops, is about how his practice of Zen Buddhism influences his approach to basketball. Phil Jackson stopped by our studio in Philadelphia yesterday. I know what our listeners here in Philly are thinking. What about Larry Brown, the coach of the Sixers? We were hoping he could join us for an interview. He's unable to do that now, but we're keeping the invitation open. This is Brown's first time in the finals. Since Jackson is a 9-time winner, I asked him what's at stake for him this time.
Terry, I think the thing that pushes a person, perhaps like myself or competitive coaches, is some of it's fear of failure. And that's something you really have to live with, is what's it like to fail. For example, the overtime game of the first game that we lost in this present series with the Philadelphia 76ers, we hadn't lost in 2 months as a basketball club. And we had won 19 consecutive games, and the amount of emotion that was going towards us to be a landslide victor, to sweep through this playoffs, was unrealistic. I knew it, the team knew it, and yet we had this kind of fantasy going on that we'd been playing so well that the loss itself, you know, kept me awake almost all night. I woke up in the middle of the night twice, and it's that kind of anxiety that goes along with this coaching job that you have to work with all the time to monitor the stress and the amount of failure that you feel from losses. And so, yeah, it's the constant pressure and push to make the team better and better and better as they even go through playoffs. And then the ultimate desire that you don't fail, that you have success, and that you don't rest on your laurels.
Puts you in a pretty impossible situation. Since you're always on top, to be anything less than perfect, you failed compared to your standard.
Well, yes, but the thing about it is it's the overall kind of picture, you know. More than anything else, Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner of the Chicago Bulls, used to say, I don't know how you can have a successful year and then try to repeat it the next year. You just have 2-3 months off, and then you try to get stimulation to do it again the next year. And as I've told this team after their successes last year, that this year would be much, much harder, which it's proved to be, because of the successes that you have. They're hard to deal with. Almost success itself breeds a certain amount of overstimulation or overpraise for oneself.
So when you woke up in the middle of the night after that first game in the finals that you lost, did you get any ideas?
Yes. Well, that's really where I think most of my ideas come from, is that semi-sleep state that you're in that sometimes feeds subconsciously ideas that stimulate you, that say this is some picture or vision that you have. And I think that's one of the things that I've been fortunate to have, that ability to make those things come real.
So what'd you think of?
Well, I saw that, you know, our super player, which was really our inspiration in a lot of ways, is Kobe Bryant. He has this wonderful kind of elan, graceful game that's, he's very ethereal quality of snaking through and finding his path and being yet 6'7", but yet small enough to fit in and get his worm his way through the court in a driving kind of manner, in which all of a sudden he'll be at the basket and finishing big at the basket, needed to have space. All of a sudden he didn't have that kind of space, and we had to reorient the court. Instead of playing at a 30 or 35-foot level, we had to start playing against his team at a 50-foot level. In other words, beyond half court, we had to start thinking about how we were going to approach the basket, and so that Kobe could approach the game that way, and he did a much better job the last couple games.
You think it has to do with that thought that you had?
It has a lot to do with it. I think that, you know, in the process, then you see how the team can flow and the players as they fit in.
So where are you psychologically now? You're ahead by one game. What are you telling your team about what kind of mental space they should be in now?
Well, it's all about getting to know your opponent is what it's about. It's about knowing their abilities and playing into what their strengths are and finding their weaknesses and exploiting their weaknesses. And you do it the team is a character. You try and exploit that character that the team has, but also the individual matchups that you have as a group. And so it takes on a rather large chess game in a match. And from game to game, then you make the adjustments. And the coach that I'm versus in this series, Larry Brown from Philadelphia, terrific coach, makes a lot of adjustments. He has maybe a play or two a game in which there'll be a different way to spring his specific player, Allen Iverson, who's really their prime mover, and make him the feature that is that night's difficulty. We have to make the adjustments on the run then. And I'm trying to do the same thing to him because he has such a great pressure team. They apply such intense pressure on the ball and the movement of players that we have to adjust our spacing and how we're going at their defense all the time.
Sunday night when you were announced before the game starts, you stand up, everybody boos. You know, Sixers fans are very, very loud and very loyal. So at least they're loyal now that the team's doing well. Anyway, so you're booed. All the members of the team are booed. And, of course, and anytime somebody's doing a free throw, all the fans behind the basket are kind of waving and throwing confetti around to distract the shooter. Does that get to you, or is it easy to get beyond that?
Last night, in the midst of that intensity with, I think it was about a minute something to go. I had a timeout. There's a little specific anxious moment there. And inside of the din of the noise, there was this quiet space inside of me that I almost marveled at, that I was, you know, still very, felt very calm. And I could try and calmly kind of, in this midst of noise, not scream, but calmly kind of relate what I wanted done to these players. And I was very thankful that I had that space and amazed that, you know, it was also there inside of me, that it was capable of being that calm and collected. It can be very anxious, and I haven't always had that. I can remember on a Mother's Day game in Madison Square Garden, that's on the fifth floor, where the crowd was so loud that you could feel the whole building moving up and down, which was an amazing feeling. It's a suspended ceiling, you know, in Madison Square Garden. And I had that feeling of being anxious for a second, being that high, five stories up, suspended floor, and that emotional rocking of that building, not just noise-wise, but physically. And I had to find a calm space, but that's basically what we teach our players. We teach our players how to do that through breath control and meditation, and I think that's really helpful for us.
Do they buy into that pretty quickly?
It's not easy. It's very difficult for these young players to do that. I have a statement that I use all the time with them, that, you know, they're going down the highway at 70 miles an hour, listening to their favorite rap music, going as loud as it can go in their $5,000 sound system, and there's rush hour traffic, and they're eating McDonald's, and all of a sudden their bite drops a glob of mustard and ketchup on their chest, and they look down, and when they look up, it's all red lights ahead of them. That's kind of how they're going through life at that speed. And the accident is just one instant away. And that what they have to do is disengage and come into space and be quiet and have to be able to monitor their own minds a little bit. It's very easy to keep it running quickly when you live this fast and you're moving this fast and you play basketball at a breakneck speed. So we try to set them and make them sit and be quiet. And it's difficult. It's difficult for them to do, and we usually break it from starting at 3 minute to 5 to 7 to 10 as we move through the season so that they can take some time and adjust to that quiet space.
Do them do anything like that during halftime?
We usually tell them to use breath, the breath, a relaxation breath at halftime. And, you know, I like to give them a what I call a safe spot or a quiet spot where they can go, and that's imagery, which is like, you know, can you remember back to the safest spot you were at when you were a kid? Can you do that, Terry?
The safest spot? I haven't thought of it that way.
You know where you would go if things weren't going right? And, you know, maybe your mother had scolded you or something, you hadn't done well on the test.
And my safest spot was always someplace in my mind, not a physical place in the room.
I had a spot that I went to, and I know what it was like. I could pull covers over my head in a bed right, and curl up in a fetal position, you know, and that was kind of it. I can remember that. And so I give them that, you know, if you have a spot that you can go to
right, that
relaxes you, I want you to be able to pull that out. And then when you go to the bench, to take those, I don't go with the players right away when they come off the floor. I give them 40 seconds. There's a minute and 20. I give them 40 seconds to take their time, get a drink, wipe the perspiration off, sit, relax. And then I want them to go to that safe spot where they can quiet themselves. And when I come in to talk to them, I want them to be receptive. And I think my guys do a really good job at doing that. But, you know, it's a different application for all of them.
Phil Jackson is my guest coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. Let's look at Allen Iverson for a second. The person who's going to give you the most trouble and has given you the most trouble on the Sixers. What's the most difficult part of figuring out how to guard him and keep him from shooting baskets, something the Lakers have done more effectively in the second and third games than in the first?
Well, we thought for a while after watching the first or the last two series that Philadelphia had versus Toronto and Milwaukee, where Allen had some really bad shooting games, that maybe we could give him shots and contest his outside shot and make him shoot 30 times to get 30 points. And, you know, maybe that would be effective. And after the first game, we realized that you've got to deny him the ball because he'll get 40 shots. And at some level, the energy that he creates by his constant, furious attack will create the energy that this team thrives on, whether he misses in the offensive rebound or he gets it back or he creates a foul. It's something that they thrive on because they have that energy that he generates for the team. And so we had to do some things like work on denial, work on which direction we wanted him to run, chase him over the top so he had to go to his left hand rather than chasing him underneath all those screens and letting him come back to his right immediately when he catches. And so you just try to work those percentages to hopefully corral him in a corner or have him in an area where he has a limited number of moves he can use because he has a number of moves that he has, and he creates his own shots very well.
He's comparatively short but really fast, so that must be really different than, having a strategy to guard somebody who's a tall guy, a tall man.
Well, what Larry Brown's done very effectively is he has kept the team concept, even though one player is really the guy that's the prime guy. He's going to touch the ball half the time, so if there's 90 possessions, he's probably going to get 40 to 45 touches in the course of a game. And yet the team can thrive on it. It was very important because you can't just automatically run two guys at him immediately when he catches the ball because he has great spacing. That's what's real important about basketball, is that he's got an available area to catch the ball and operate. And so that's one of the things. But what Allen does is his speed and his athleticism give him the opportunity to do so many things that he develops things for his teammates. Assists, penetration. He's able to move the ball well enough when he gets double-teamed. And that's the most remarkable thing because a fellow that's that size at 6 foot in this game, getting smothered by guys 6'8 to 7 feet, usually doesn't have the vision. But he's got good vision. Even if he doesn't see, he knows where his players are to make the pass that's available.
My guest is Phil Jackson, coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. He has a new book called More Than a Game. He's in Philadelphia preparing for Game 4 against the 76ers in the NBA Finals. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Phil Jackson, and he's in Philadelphia with his team with doing the finals. And he has a new book, which is called More Than a Game, which he co-authored with Charlie Rosen. In Sunday night's game, Shaquille O'Neal fouled out. What have you been suggesting to him to prevent that from happening in the next game?
Well, one of the things we know about Shaquille is that the road versus home is a different matter for us. Because of his intimidating size and his presence, about every move he makes is either fans are calling 3 seconds or offensive foul or something that's, you know, they're, you know, really on his every move. And so Shaquille gets more foul trouble. He gets in more offensive fouls. He gets more 3 seconds in the lane, those kind of violations during the course of a away game. So we're trying to tell him to limit his activity but not stop his game. And Shaquille in the first half of the game had a lot of nice, easy turnaround jump shots, jump hooks. In the second half of the game, they came after him with double teams, and he tried to spin out of the double teams, and you know, they were able to create offensive fouls by that activity level. They really put him under a squeeze.
He, in one of the press conference talks after the game, said that he thought Mutombo was whining and flopping.
Right.
And he said, and you can underline that. You can quote me. What do you think about that? Do you think that was fair?
It was probably fair. As I say, everybody else, you know, when you play a game like this was played, it's a very, very physical game, body on body, which is totally against what the rules were supposed to be in the NBA, which was against hand-checking. You can't impede body progress of basketball players on their cuts or dribbling the ball. But when it gets to this level, those rules kind of fly out the window. They can't call everything because there's so much intensity. So they say, we'll let him play a little bit. You can let everybody play, but you can't let Shaq play. He's just too incredible. He's too strong, and he's too capable that no one can really stop him. What Shaq does is he makes a pivot, and what you can do when you pivot is that you can use your extended arm and your shoulder in a pivot without getting an offensive foul. As long as you're pivoting, if you step back and hit somebody with an arm, that is an offensive foul. But if you're using what is considered a pivot move, you have that legal right in that space. And so depending upon how it's looked at, you know, it can be the old offense defensive charging thing that, you know, goes on as a judgment call for referees, and it's a lot easier for him to get that on the road than is at home. And what Shaq, I think, was referring to by Mutombo's flopping was, come out and play me with that same kind of intensity everybody else is playing, and I'll play you body on body.
Are you saying, too, that you think the officials had a double standard?
They have a double standard for Shaquille. They have to. If they didn't tilt it a little ways, I mean, he would be almost impossible to stop.
Let me quote something that you say in your book, and the book is called More Than a Game.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, the vast majority of NBA coaches are simply afraid to talk about how the game is officiated. We're intimidated by the absolute power of the referees to control a ball game.
We are, because as you saw in the last series with Milwaukee here in Philadelphia, the players again for Philadelphia or for Milwaukee complained about the fact that they weren't getting foul calls, and they actually lost some poise and control, and there was a number of fines that were levied against that team. So arbitrarily, the league, you know, will fine people, and those fines carry with it not only that, you know, financial remuneration to the league, but also there's a certain feeling that if you do that, then you get them on against you. You're going to pay the price eventually by the officials. So you're intimidated by the fact that, you know, you've criticized the officials. Our officiating in our league is great. We can't complain about it. These guys have poise and they have control and they're professionals. It's an impossible game to referee. I think if one was sitting here beside me, they'd say the same thing because it happens so fast and it's so judgmental.
What's the worst time you've lost your temper recently with an official?
You know, I got thrown out of a game in the last series in the finals of the West, in which I never was either against the referees or said a word about them, and I was ejected out of the ball game, which was it was an unfair situation. But in the course of the thing, the players were so calm and controlled. They knew that it was an unfair situation. I was removed from the game, that they used it as a motivational tool. And we went on a little run, and we were behind at the time. And it looked like a motivational tool from my standpoint, even though it wasn't. I was trying to just be part of the game and just be influential. And bam, they took off, and he had a great game from that point on. So without losing my temper, something positive happened. Now, when I went in the locker room, I was very upset about not being able to see the rest of the game. And I could vent in the locker room then at that time.
And so what were you thrown out for?
Encroaching on a referee's space. Now, there's a coaching box that basically you're not supposed to get on the court. You're not supposed to cross the line onto the court when the play is in action. And there's a limit that you can walk the court up to the scorer's desk. There's a little slash mark there. But there's a place, a space out there where the referees want to stand, which is at the free throw line extended. So you can stand behind them or alongside of them. And I was standing alongside of the referee below the free throw line, and he wanted more space. And I said, I don't understand why you want more space. And for that, he gave me a technical. I'd already had one other technical in the game, so I was removed. The other technical I got in the game was for making a signal. Basically, I just, you know, kind of hit my fist into my open hand. And the other referee that hadn't made the call said that I was intimidating the other referee. But I realized then that the pressures that these referees are working under must be tremendous, and I had to back off the rest of the series. I've been very less vocal and very less animated.
Do you think that any of the referees ever think, oh, well, there's the Zen guy venting, you know?
They put you to the test. They really do. And a lot of times I have a good relationship with them in working relationship. A lot of times when I see that they're upset, I'll come out and just say, you know, you're okay. You know, it's all right. You know, just stay under control. This is a good game. Just keep it going. I like to encourage the referees to have a good game. I don't like to bend them my direction so much.
Phil Jackson is the coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. They play against the Philadelphia 76ers in Game 4 of the NBA Finals tomorrow night. Jackson also has a new book called More Than a Game. Our conversation was recorded yesterday. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, coaching Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant, we continue our conversation with L.A. Lakers coach Phil Jackson. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Phil Jackson, coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. They're in Philadelphia playing against the 76ers in the NBA Finals. Jackson has already won the championship 9 times, last year with the Lakers, 6 times as coach of the Chicago Bulls, and twice as a player with the New York Knicks. Jackson has a new book called More Than a Game that covers his time with the Lakers. Our conversation was recorded yesterday. Let's talk about your strategy with Kobe Bryant, a great shooter. You say that when you got to the Lakers, your problem with him was he didn't really want to be a team player. He wanted to be the star. He wanted people to follow him, but he wasn't that good at teamwork.
Kobe vaulted right to the NBA as an 18-year-old kid and took his lessons, so to speak, in graduate work in the NBA rather than going to college. He's a very bright kid, and he's very astute. And when I was first signed by the Lakers 2 years ago in June, he was there at the signing with the book. Sacred Hoops was the name of that book. He had Sacred Hoops with him, a book about a little bit about the offense and about my philosophy. And we talked a lot. He was very anxious to work inside this system of basketball that I like to work at. However, it really didn't match his style of play. It requires a lot of giving up the basketball and moving without the basketball. We say that the principles in this offense, you know, all things given, you know, the ball's in your hands 20% of the time if there are 5 players on the court. And Kobe wanted it in his hands more, 80% of the time or whatever. And that's a real sense of power on the basketball court, is to have the ball in your hands a lot, because you can make the plays, you can make the shot. You can't get shots if it's not in your hands. So I had to really talk to Kobe about being a guard, being a playmaker, and how to make everybody else feel really important and good about what you're doing for the team. And it just can't be you making spectacular plays. And he's grown a lot and a tremendous amount. And in the book, More Than a Game, we talk a little bit about that in the course. We had a struggle last year as we came through the year. And Shaquille felt a little bit that Kobe was trying to make too many plays on his own when he could make an easier play. My complaint with Kobe was that, or my play with Kobe was that, if you give up the ball instead of putting yourself in a dangerous situation when you go to the basket, you're going to be healthier, you're going to feel better, you're going to get through the season into the playoffs in a position where you can really put yourself all out on the court. But right now we want to play a control game, and we want to help our teammates out, and to make the plays is the most important thing. And so we had a little bit of an issue about that this year, again, in Rose again, and a lot was made out of it, and I think a lot of growth happened on our team because of it. And the team went through the period of time in about 2 or 3 days. It took a week for us to get over it, but then it lingered because it's a publicity thing. It's like a divorce or marital kind of thing going on with people that are famous. It's going to come back and be public issue. And every time we had to go on the road to the next town, it got harbored on time and time again. And finally, the players had to almost heal it themselves by just ignoring it and just going on by it and letting it happen.
Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal are not only like the star players of the team, they're the celebrities of the team. You know, they have endorsements and they have their rap records, whether they're released or not.
Right.
And, you know, Shaquille O'Neal has been in a movie. I mean, they're big celebrities. Is it harder when players become celebrities to take direction from their coach?
Yes, it is. It's natural that you follow, you know, young men will follow their own instincts or their own advice. But yes, you're right. The amount of money that you make, the amount of energy that's formed around these ball players when they generate millions of dollars that they create in a year, the people follow, flock, listen, obey, coddle them in many ways, and so it makes it difficult to give the kind of direct orders that you as a leader want to do. So it has to be more subtle, persuasive. And I think most of us in this society are doing a much better job of that than it was when I was a kid or you were a kid in the 50s and the 60s, that, people were pretty authoritarian. There was Mr. and Mrs. and you did this and that, and you went to school and you shut up and sat down at a certain time and stood up and put your hand over your heart and said the national, the pledge to the flag. But, we're much better in this country at doing that kind of thing now, and it's got a better approach, and I think the coaches have made that adjustment. And Larry Brown's one of them that's made a really big adjustment, have really survived and blossomed under that.
I want to quote something from the book, and this is about Shaquille O'Neal. You say, he's a very endearing person who nevertheless always gave the impression that he's never having fun on the court. I told him that I expected his true personality to come to the fore. Why would that be important, to show that he's having fun on the court?
Because that's who he is. And I think that, you know, what you are in this game of basketball really comes through. Your true nature, your true personality, basketball really exposes people. You kind of like, you think you get to know people that are out there. And Shaquille is really a fun-loving guy, and he can also be an overpowering guy, an overwhelming person. And I'd like to see him in that fun-loving area of playing basketball more than I like to see him in that overpowering area where he's light and nifty and freewheeling and very, very athletic for, I'm not even going to say for a guy his size, he's just athletic. Doesn't matter if he's 7 foot.
So how did he take to that suggestion?
Well, I think he's taken very well to it. And I've really enjoyed the fact that, you know, at one time his interviews were so subdued and so monotone and so flat that I thought that he was, you know, underplaying who he really was. And I think he's been able to pick it up, to liven it up, to be very funny, to expose himself. And, I mean, I even get a kick out of watching, although I don't watch TV very little, the Nestle commercials that they show him picking up the machine. And you can see his fun-loving attitude, you know, in the tights with the ribbons that he's doing, the dance routine, funny stuff. And that's Shaquille. He likes to clown.
What did you learn about Shaq's strengths and vulnerabilities from playing against him with the Bulls?
That he's really headstrong. And that, you know, if you push him in a certain way, he's still going to try and do it his way, and that you can use that to work against him. And so I've tried to talk to him about being more malleable and more adjustable, and so he doesn't feel like, you know, he's got to run through the wall every time, that he can make the adjustments. And that, I think, is really an important aspect for him, is that willfulness is great, but willfulness used correctly is even better.
My guest is Phil Jackson, coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. He also has a new book called More Than a Game. He's in Philadelphia, where the Lakers are playing against the 76ers in the NBA Finals. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Phil Jackson, coach of the L.A. Lakers. They're playing against the Philadelphia 76ers in the NBA Finals. Sometimes players will try to, as he's about to make a shot, to foul him, figuring he's not going to make the foul shots. He won't make the basket, and then he won't make the foul shots, so just go ahead and foul him. There's even a name for that, Hack-a-Shaq.
Right.
So he did real well Sunday night with his free throws. He had 8 out of 9?
Yes, he was very good. He didn't get any free throws the second half, but the first half, I thought it really changed the dimension of our game because everybody grows in confidence when he does that. And you saw his shot was feathery and light and looked like it had a nice touch on it.
So what did you do to encourage him to work on the free throws?
Well, Shaquille's, that's Achilles' heel, and it's not him alone as a big guy. There's a lot of big guys in this game that have not perfected the free throw shooting. But for him particularly, it was his Achilles heel. And when I coached against him in one playoffs in 94, I think he shot almost 70% from that series. And I had what was known then as the three-headed monster attack, that I would sacrifice my three centers to foul him when he got the ball close to the basket. He blames me to this day for starting that Hack-a-Shaq thing. And I said, well, I never fouled you off the ball when the ball wasn't in your hands so that you had to make the ball. And I think that's against the rules of the game. So that series, I saw him really step into that challenge and make all those free throws and eliminate the Bulls. This is the year that Michael came back for 17 games. And when I got to the Lakers, I encouraged him to, you know, to do something with his free throw shooting outside of our coaching staff. I like players that want specific things sometimes to do it outside of the coaching staff. And he started attending to it very, very much with great dedication. I mean, spending 3 hours sometimes at a time just to get it back down. You know, three times a week he'd get into our gym, maybe at night, and shoot from 7 to 9. And just took hours and hours to put himself in a position where he could try and do this. It's been a real hurdle for him.
It seems like it's important to him not only to, because he needs to make those points, but also I think his playing, he gets frustrated when he doesn't make the baskets, and that throws him off.
It's very embarrassing. I mean, that's the embarrassing thing because everybody in the arena, you know, is yelling at you to miss.
Right.
They all expect you to miss. And, you know, all those balloons that you were referring to before, yeah, that are going crazy behind, yeah, the basket, are as distracting at all. And all you have to do is just one moment have that self-doubt at that moment. It's enough to change, you know, what you can possibly do up there at the free throw line. And Shaquille has a broken wrist at one time, so he can't use the normal flow that a person would use with the wrist being able to bend almost 90 degrees to the arm so that you have that nice loop in your shot. So he has to kind of put the ball on his hand a little bit differently from that broken hand. And as a result, it takes a different kind of mechanical skill for him to get the touch and the length of the shot that he needs for a free throw.
Frustration seems to be a problem for him, not only with free throws, but, you know, if something goes wrong, it's going to get to him. And you even write about, in your book, More Than a Game, you write about how once he actually tore the locker room apart. I mean, he threw all the tables over and things were just all over the place because of a bad mood he'd gotten into as a result of frustration. What happened, and, you know, as the coach, what did you tell him about that?
Well, it's only happened once since I've been on the team, but I know it happened before I got here. And the frustrations, it happened at different times. And I'd heard obliquely kind of about them. And when I got here early in the my first season a year ago, we had a game in Dallas. And Dallas is one of the teams that uses the hack-a-shack attack, where they'll foul off the ball at any time as soon as the penalty is, so they can get the ball back, hopefully, with maybe 1 point or no points. The Shaq was shooting poorly in the foul line. And I think he was like 2 for 14, so that means that it's almost like having 7 turnovers to go like that. And he went in the locker room and tore the TV off the wall mount, which we use for video aids before the game. And, you know, I came in and went off on the team. This is unacceptable. You know, this is behavior that I can't accept, you know. Maybe you want to beat your head against the wall, but don't. Who did this, you know? And not thinking that was Shaq, and he pointed to, we have a real tiny player on our team named Ty Lewis, about the same size as Allen Iverson. And he said, Ty did it. And then everybody laughed and kind of got over it. And he went out the second half and he was fine.
Yeah.
And then I talked to him afterwards about it. I really didn't like that. I mean, I know he'd done it before, but I really didn't like a display of anger that was taken out on something else. I'd like him to be able to channel that and use it for himself.
Do you feel like you got results on that?
Well, so far it's been good. I haven't had any incidents like that since.
He says in his book, the greatest lesson Phil taught me was poise, not to take myself out of a game because I was frustrated and wanted to punch somebody. he also says in his book that the first thing you asked him to do was lose 15 pounds.
Yeah. Probably more. I think I said 30 to him, but
he only remembered 15 of them, apparently.
He's split it in half. you know, Shaq is I don't know, you remember the comics Baby Huey when you were little?
Yeah.
Baby Huey was like this gigantic kid that was bigger than everybody. Shaq is kind of like Baby Huey. God gave him a gift that, you know, is like he's just been huge probably his whole life. He's just been this immense kid that has had this size and this athleticism that's been just this, God-given talent. And as he's grown older, as all of us do, most of us do, at least not you, Terry, but I have, he's put on some weight. It's just natural, and he's done some weight training. And he's gotten himself up over 300 pounds. And what happens to ball players is they develop tendonitis, particularly pounding up and down on those legs. They get tendonitis in the knees. And for me, I thought Shaq could lose some weight and still not suffer any from lack of strength or size and gain back a little more of his career, perhaps more longevity in his game.
Did he lose?
Well, he did that year, but he came back this year a little bit heavier than he was last year when he started the season, even though he wouldn't admit to it. And of course, our scales don't weigh him. We'd have to take him to a football team scale or grain elevators, whatever you can weigh it. And but he says next year he's coming in at 298. He wants to be under 300. I don't know if he's kidding with me or not.
Phil Jackson is my guest, coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. And by the way, he does have a new book, which is called More Than a Game. And it's mostly about coaching the Lakers and developing his coaching technique. Can you compare the experience of coaching the Lakers and the Bulls?
No. It's still coaching, but it's so different. It's such a different team. It's such a different relationship that I have with the team. I'm the same person in many ways, different group of guys. The team in Chicago were mostly young married men with young families. It was a kind of a community of young kids growing up together, wives and families that were involved and intertwined. There was really a remarkable resilience about that team because they supported each other just unequivocally. Their roles were ordered almost impeccably from Michael through Scottie Pippen, down through the order of the players. It just all related very well as to how they had to do it. They could support a character like Dennis Rodman for three years, even though he was, a maverick in many ways. And there was an end in sight. They knew that it was, there was an age in this team. They knew that, hey, we're going to last this year. Maybe we'll get one more year. We got that one more year, and then maybe we could do it again, and we had a three-peat championship. But those players all moved into maybe retirement or moved on or quit the game. And this group is a bunch of young players. It's a different generation. There's very few guys are married. There's not that community. And yet we have a community that's altogether different and still vibrant and very tight.
I'm wondering if the age difference between you and the players, as you get older and the players stay more or less the same age or even younger than the previous team you coached, if there's certain differences that are difficult to reconcile, and what I'm thinking of particularly is the whole respect thing, the meaning of respect to a lot of people in their 20s now, and the meaning of disrespect and what can be interpreted as disrespect is probably really different than, for instance, when you were playing or when
Definitely.
You started coaching.
Without a doubt, Terry, I think you hit that point very well, that it's... The last time we were in Philadelphia to play, Kobe and I had a little bit of a tiff on the bench, and I actually felt that he was trying to do too much on the court, and he wanted to argue with me, and so I sat him on the bench. I was willing to sit him in a certain point in the game that I felt was important. Shaq was out of the game, so we were out without two of our stars for that period of time, but I wanted to let him know that I didn't want him to argue with me at that point. When we got in the locker room, we had another discussion. And he felt like I disrespected him by imposing upon him the fact that he was being selfish, again, cubbyholing him into this curtain. And I said, fine, we'll watch the tape together again and sort it out tomorrow. So I realized, there was that's one disrespect, that, don't pigeonhole me with what you think that I was doing that, is a preconceived idea that you have of my game. And the game itself is played to a little different beat. Hip-hop and that kind of generational noise that's going on has a lot of kind of gangster not being respected, being oppressed, riding the line, living at the edge, willing to sacrifice yourself for your own honor. Those kind of things I think are big parts of the culture in this group of youth right now. And I have to respect that for whatever it's worth. As much as I wanted my elders to respect my particular beliefs that I had in the late 60s about war and about countries going to war and about youth being drafted and so forth. So, I mean, I have to respect where they're coming from and wonder where it's taking them to.
But some of that goes against some of your values, that living on the edge and the speed and a lot of the kind of bragging. Of rap and the kind of thug aspects of it, that kind of goes against who you are as a coach and what you want from your players as a coach.
Well, the part that I like about coaching is my ability to influence. I've been able to kind of take them through, like violence is gun violence appropriate, you know, and the idea of possessing and owning guns and making them think those thoughts. And I like the fact that Martin Luther King Day, we have a game on that day, and I can always talk about, you know, Martin Luther King and peaceful resistance, and, you know, and the ability for people to make things happen without having to take armed stands, you know, and having to defend oneself through rational, reasonable approaches.
My guest is Phil Jackson, coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. He also has a new book called More Than a Game. He's in Philadelphia, where the Lakers are playing against the 76ers in the NBA Finals. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Coach Phil Jackson is my guest, and by the way, he has a new book, and it's called More Than a Game. Now, you're on camera a lot during the games.
Yes.
Are you conscious of that, and are you trying to maintain a public face, knowing that at any minute there might be a cutaway to you?
Well, I think we've all had our embarrassing moments on film that are coaches or players, that you're, you know, either caught in a position where you're yelling or something's happened to you, or, you know, you might even be wiping your nose or whatever. But every action that's a reaction, the camera comes back to you. And I've gotten used to that over the years, and I try to remain really equal about my emotions at that time and not to vent or not to do anything. But I learned that lesson not so much from the camera, but from, you know, having a player like Dennis Rodman on the team, who fed directly almost off the emotional state of the coach. Mm-hmm. And I realized that the more animated I got, the more animated he felt he had to be, and it would create this chain reaction. And I felt that the calmer and the easier I was on the whole attitude of the game, the better he felt about the game, and the team responded likewise. And so I've tried to maintain that since that time.
Yeah, I like one sports columnist said something like, Phil Jackson uncrossed his leg. You know, like, wow, what emotion he showed.
Yeah, people always say, you're not doing much coaching over there.
I want to quote one more thing from your book, More Than a Game. You say, in 1998, after 44 years of being continuously involved with basketball, I cashed in my chips and, quote, retired after winning my sixth championship with the Bulls. In the middle of the journey that is my life, I had lost my way. What did you mean by that, by having lost your way before getting back to basketball?
Well, really, the career in basketball, it became, you know, so dominant in my life that I felt like I had lost my kids, my family. You know, they were all gone off to college, you know, in the process. It was almost impossible for me. I had four in college, same time, twins, when he was freshman. And it was almost impossible to stay in touch with them at some level with the amount of traveling and everything. And it felt like, you know, somehow or other I kind of lost the whole process of this family that I was very, very, very connected to for many years. And as they'd grown up, become less and less connected as more and more basketball pressures kept coming in, particularly when, you know, season's over 2 months ago, basically, in the NBA, a normal NBA season, 82 games, you work 5.5 months, and you have that time with your family. When you're in the end result, so many times, like I've been over the last 10 years, it really separates you from your family. And now you've got July and August before school starts again, basically, to reconnect. And, you know, I went through a period of separation with my wife and, you know, been separated since I've gone to L.A. and she's remained in New York, as we found that, you know, there's a different way that we're going to travel, I suppose, the rest of this life. And for a period of time, it was very devastating for me because I felt like I'd lost my family. But I found that I hadn't lost my family at all. We'd just grown to different positions. And, you know, the kids are here with me in Philadelphia, and it's great. I have five kids and lots of kids, and they love to come to the finals. It's become like a family ritual, and it's amazing that they can be here.
Just one last question. What are you doing and what are you advising your players to do until the next game to kind of keep focused, not party or drink too much? Just, you know, because there's between Sunday and Wednesday, you got a few days there.
It's all recuperation. One of the things that I'll mention just in this last question is that, you know, I kind of, you know, we have this Wednesday, Friday home, and then we go on the road Sunday, Wednesday, Friday. In the period of time between those games, Friday in L.A. and Sunday in Philadelphia, we have a day of travel. Philadelphia chose to travel after the ball game and flew all night. And I've kind of learned over the course of time that you can miss a whole day and travel on that day and, you know, recuperate, hopefully, and have a good game, because it's all your nervous system has to recover from that intense noise and energy and adrenaline flow. And that's what I tell you, get plenty of rest, food, and fluids. You know, that's one of the most important things. And then get a really good night's sleep on Tuesday night, and then you'll be ready to go. You'll be regenerated by Wednesday. And I think we'll see a different Philadelphia team on Wednesday, one that's much more rejuvenated than we had and much more active than was last night.
Phil Jackson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, Terry, it's always a pleasure. I love your show.
Phil Jackson, coach of the Los Angeles Lakers, recorded yesterday at the Fresh Air Studio in Philadelphia. The Lakers are in Philadelphia playing against the 76ers in the NBA Finals. The Lakers are ahead 2-1. Game 4 is tomorrow night. Jackson also has a new book called More Than a Game. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at saabusa.com. And from Dell Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of The Greatest Generation by Tom Brokaw, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Here's some advice from Mel Brooks.
Listen to Terry Gross, Fresh Air. Mel Brooks is our guest.
We'll talk to Mel Brooks about the hottest show on Broadway, his show, The Producers. It's springtime for Hitler on the next Fresh Air.